Hello and welcome to the Propel Podcast. I'm your host, Tim East, and I'm thrilled to be here with you. I'm the Propel and International Workstream Lead, and I've spent years working at the intersection of healthcare and technology, and I'm passionate about how innovation is transforming healthcare and the way we live. This podcast is all about diving into the latest breakthroughs in health tech, hearing from the visionary leaders, shaping the industry, and exploring how cutting-edge solutions are improving patient care, wellness, and access to healthcare. Whether you're a healthcare professional, a tech enthusiast, or someone simply curious about the future of health, this podcast is for you. Each episode will bring you insightful conversations with experts, share inspiring stories of innovation, and highlight the trends that are making waves in health tech. In today's episode, I'm joined by Michael Morgan Curran, the CEO of Asclepius MedTech, a digital health tech company that has a mission to improve the quality of life and outcomes for patients that are undergoing lower abdominal and orthopedic surgeries. By tackling the morbidity associated with these major surgeries, and to positively impact millions of patients' lives. Their product SurgeFit is the first remote patient assessment system for preoperative surgical assessment, with remote 24/7 surgical assessment as an alternative to being hospital practice. This provides surgical teams with comprehensive physiological and functional capability with reports to enhance shared decision making and improve patient outcomes. Michael, thanks for joining us today and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Tim, and thanks for that glowing preface. That was brilliant. Thank you.
Okay, so starting off, can you tell us about your journey into health tech and what inspired you to work in this field?
Yeah, thanks very much, Tim. God, that's a big question. Gosh, I've been around since aspirin first came into effect, actually. It feels like that. I'm very fortunate, Tim. I've had a long career in pharma and life sciences before I branched into med tech, various sales and marketing and market access roles with many of the big pharma companies, which everybody knows, like AstraZeneca, GSK, et cetera, et cetera. And it was my last role in pharma where I was responsible for global innovation with AstraZeneca. And it was while I was doing that role that we were exploring the impact of digital products and services. And what we wanted to try and do was to see whether they could improve patient outcomes and experience, whether they could demonstrate some healthcare outcomes, improve the experience of patients that were on our pharma products, and at the same time, figure out whether we could change the sales and marketing mix as a result of using digital technologies, and therefore develop maybe more dynamic sales teams that could be fit for purpose, because the environment was changing. You know, access to GPs and hospital doctors was changing, and therefore we needed to figure out different ways of being able to communicate with our clinicians that would eventually be supporting patients on our pharma products. And so that got me a real taste for how medtech could be used. And this was way at the very beginning, before digital health had really become a concept. We hadn't seen the impact of mobile technologies at that stage. You know, we were still very much using web-based digital enterprises and web-based digital solutions to try and reach and communicate with our stakeholders. But I knew that was changing, because I knew that the reach of smartphones was going to become astronomical, which is what it is. You know, currently about 54% of the global population have now got a smartphone. That's, you know, roughly about 4.3 billion people, you know, and that's been driven by the accessibility to mobile technologies and the affordability of them in different markets around the world. But anyway, that gave me a real, as I said, a real taste for digital health and the positive impact it could possibly have on patients' lives. And it was from there that I was offered a job at the GSMA. Some people might not have heard of the GSMA. It's the Trade Association for the Mobile Phone Industry. And I was asked to lead their global health program at the time. In that role, I was lucky enough to travel extensively across the world, and I was setting up digital health projects with ministries of health, hospitals, and in-country mobile operators. And some of the projects were very, very basic when we compare to what we've got now, but they were certainly the precursor of where digital health would be going. You know, we've seen the surge in connected technologies now, and we take it for granted that interoperability exists, you know, and the data can freely flow between mobile devices and apps. You may not even be aware of it, but the GSMA coined the phrase IoT, Internet of Things, you know. Mm. And then we obviously developed the medical device IoT phraseology as well. Mm. So the GSMA were really, really at the, you know, at the forefront of driving forward mHealth, mobile health, as we call it, and digital health. And that exposure to, you know, different countries around the world, different ministries of health, different healthcare organizations, got me really interested in this new surge in medtech startups that were happening. At the same time, I was lucky enough to start mentoring some innovators in these startup companies. But at the same time, I was conscious of the fact that I was helping make money for other people. So I decided that I wanted to start making money for myself. So I started a couple of startups. One failed miserably, and one we sold. And so now I lead Asclepius MedTech, and I'm really proud of the fact that we have an impressive team of surgeons, senior NHS managers, and talented technologists supporting us.
That's an amazing background, and it must have been really interesting seeing the emergence of that technology and the application of it, the potential application of it.
It was, actually. But you've got to remember, there was no formal training around this. So when it came to medtech, I was pretty much self-taught. You know, I learned an awful lot from the mobile operators. I learned an awful lot from the healthcare organizations that I was working with. You know, and I'd say I'm fairly competent when it comes to medtech now, actually, and I can hold my own. You know, I have a phrase, if I don't know something, I know someone who does, you know. And so what I tend to do is I surround myself with really talented and experienced people, because I'm not too proud to admit that if I don't know something and I can ask for help. But it was a really, really, really interesting journey, actually.
Health tech's not the easiest market anyway to enter, but I presume you've got some battle wounds from that journey. I guess along the way you've faced quite a few challenges. Is there any specific ones that sort of stand out for you?
One of the biggest challenges in my career to date was that I had no official training in the med tech team. So I had to be fairly self-taught. You know, while I was at the GSMA, and even now, you know, I still don't know everything, you know. But what I tend to do is I surround myself with talented people, experienced people. But I think one of the other big challenges is getting buy-in from stakeholders, you know. Because sometimes if you've got a brand new innovation, which is quite cutting edge, there will be, you know, there will be challenges by, you know, getting people to understand what you're trying to try and do and what support you need from them, you know. The other challenge with all medtech, actually, is that there may not be the funding, and therefore it might be difficult to procure within organizations. Sometimes when you're building a tech, you think the metrics that you have are the ones that are really going to drive your value proposition, and sometimes they're not, you know. So you have to really work with your stakeholders to make sure that your product is going to fit, it's going to do what it's going to do, and that you can measure the effectiveness of it. So those are some of the key challenges associated with all medtech.
Yeah, and I guess dealing with so many different stakeholders, I think it's the human element of understanding that some stakeholders may just not be interested. You know, they might have different priorities. Have you found that?
Exactly. I mean, sometimes the benefit of your product may not be realized by the people that will actually be using it. You know, the benefits may be delivered downstream. And, you know, and that causes problems with the business plan, you know, and the value proposition. Value propositions are really, really important, you know, and it's something which all companies really need to think about quite systematically. And you'll end up with different value propositions for different stakeholders, different customers, you know. And therefore, your messaging and how you position your product will have to change. And some of the metrics that you're building into measuring the effectiveness of your technology will have to fit with those different stakeholders. The biggest failing that innovators do is that they just don't engage with the broader community. They don't identify who are the essential key stakeholders and who are all the influencers in the system and what benefit are they going to receive from using your technology. And then it's about connecting all of those people together. You know, as the innovator, you have to leverage all of those connections to make sure that everybody understands what you're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. And I've had the privilege of seeing you in action, shall we say. You know, you're networking and you're very good at getting that insight. You know, who is this person? What's their position? How can you, you know, give them that information that they're needing for supporting your case, really?
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I've always had a golden rule, is that some relationships and conversations you have with people may not deliver
what you want at that time period. You know, mm-hmm. it may well be that they play a role later on down the line or in further conversations, or maybe you influence them to influence somebody else. You know, you should really be engaging with as many people as possible, because no one person is responsible for delivery. It's a whole team within a hospital or in a primary care setting. Yeah, so networking is extremely important, and you should never burn your bridges, Tim. You know?
Yeah.
Never burn your bridges, you know. And the thing is, you know, in healthcare organizations, including the NHS, and I'm very proud of the NHS, is that nobody in the NHS comes to work to do a bad job, you know. Mm-hmm. They all want to meet the needs of patients. They all want to deliver high quality care, you know. And people will work with you when they have the space and the opportunity to. And indeed, your innovation is meeting some of their needs. Needs-based analysis is really incredibly important when you're driving your insights into your business.
And do you find the case of sometimes the NHS doesn't really understand what they need? You know, there's the struggle with that, the art of the possible, I suppose. You know, they don't know what they don't know type thing.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that. I'd say that most people in the NHS are working full steam ahead at 99% of the time. You know, they don't have an awful lot of headroom within their roles to really think about what's working well, what isn't working well. And it depends on what level you are within the NHS. You know, and some people are responsible for strategic priorities and driving them through, and then they cascade that down to the rest of the teams within the hospitals or the primary care environments. And, you know, there is very little space, as I said, for innovation, for them to stop and think about how they could maybe change and do things. But I know the NHS is culturally wanting to change that, which is great. We were very lucky enough to be at a meeting with the Department of Health and Social Care recently with the MedTech team there. And they are definitely trying to make strides in culturally changing the NHS so that they can have more headroom for thinking about how they could do service improvements or improvements to care quality, and allowing people culturally the ambition to try and think about what they're doing and make some changes. And that will mean that they will then be more receptive to external organizations that might come in with a solution that might try and meet those. But going back to the insights bit, if you're an innovator and you've mapped out the care pathway or the patient pathway, and you've identified where there are some issues and needs, and you've built your technology around that, then that's the kind of conversation you need to be having. You know, this is something which can help you do X, help you do Y, and we'd like to work with you to do that. But the other thing about insights is you need to have the evidence. You know, you need to know what's going wrong. You need to be able to measure it. You need to be able to characterize it. And as I said, build it into that value proposition, which is meaningful for those stakeholders. Nurses have got different needs to surgeons, to other clinicians, to hospital managers, to procurement teams. They've all got different issues. And you need to make sure that you're tailoring your messaging and your value proposition around those.
So moving on to your company, your organization, what does your company aim to achieve?
Well, you were very good at the beginning because you did characterize it incredibly well. So thank you for that. So yeah, you're right. Our mission is to improve the quality of life and outcomes for patients undergoing lower abdominal and orthopedic surgeries. And we believe definitely that we can impact millions of patients' lives for the better. So we are helping hospitals transform their current surgical preoperative assessment services. And the biggest difference is that we're shifting that service out of the hospital into patients' own homes. That's never been done before. You know, current surgical preoperative assessment is done in hospital. And we've seen very little innovation in this space for many, many, many years. And what we're hoping to do is to help the hospitals deliver safer, more effective and efficient surgical care and improve productivity and drive down costs. Now, the reason why is that Asclepius is made up of surgeons, NHS managers, and quite experienced medtech technologists. So we do understand the current needs of hospitals and the challenges that they're faced in providing safer, more effective surgical care. You see, all pre-op teams, you know, whether it's in the UK or whether it's in Europe or whether it's in the US or the Middle East, they all know that preoperative risk stratification of patients is vital. And it's vital in order to achieve the best surgical outcomes for patients. And at the moment, there are no assessment tools that provide objective, precise, and an inexpensive method that incorporates longitudinal physiological data. Instead, the methods that they use are reliant on what we call physical fitness biomarker analysis. They all rely on snapshot data, and it doesn't give a full picture of the patient's physical health at all. Now, there is one standard test which is generally used quite a lot in the UK, but it's not used in the rest of the world. It's cardiopulmonary exercise testing. And that involves the person attending the hospital and then performing what we call a graduated exercise test on a bicycle, effectively. And it's designed to estimate their fitness for surgery. It's a great tool, but unfortunately, about 10 to 15% of patients can't even get on the bike in the first place. And that's part of the reason why it's not systematically used in other countries around the world. And at the same time, if you've got a patient coming into hospital, unfortunately, the data is affected by what we call white coat syndrome as well. And so therefore, there's reduced data power from those single tests.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that's looking at creating efficiencies, so getting the data before the patient's actually in hospital.
Exactly. So that probably leads me on to maybe exploring a bit more about SurgeFit itself. So what we do is we generate more powerful data sets than the current pre-op assessment can do so that we can better risk stratify patients based on their fitness for surgery and complication risk. And the aim there is to improve surgical outcomes, reduce clinical risk, affect faster post-op recovery and discharge, and at the same time, increase service capacity because it's a remote at-home service as opposed to an in-hospital service, and then generate in-year cash savings as well.
And I'm guessing there's the patient angle on it as well. So if they're having the assessment in their own environment, their home, they're going to feel a lot more comfortable with that before actually going into hospital.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if I just describe to you what SurgeFit is, well, we use wearable technologies in order to collect the data. So that's why we say it's positioned in patient's own home. They wear a regulated class 2A biosensor patch on their chest. And that's recording data for up to 7 days continuously, or vital healthcare data, the same data that the clinicians would be recording in the hospital in the pre-op visit. So that's your ECG, your heart rate, your temperature, respiration rate, activity. And we could even detect falls in the home as well. And the patients also are given a mobile phone, which is preloaded with the Sleepless app on it. And the app is essential in order to record the data from the patch and send it back up to the cloud. The app is preloaded and the pre-op team in the hospital can send bespoke questionnaires to the patient for them to fill in. Those questionnaires are capturing what we call their functional capacity data. So that's things like their health history, their stress, activity, pain, their mood, things like that. All things which are really, really important to build a better picture of the patient's physicality and their emotional state. And we even record data on what their post-op recovery is likely to be. So all of that data is then relayed, as I said, in real time back to the hospital, and it's viewed by the pre-op team at a distance. So you can see all of a sudden that the patient experience and patient journey has been changed quite dramatically, you know. So you can immediately see the efficiency gain that can be achieved by using a Sleepless as opposed to the current pre-op services as well. And of course, you know, being an out-of-hospital service, it means that it complements the NHS net zero ambitions as well. It's done in a more timely fashion. You know, Sleepius means, because you can give the SurgeFit advices to patients earlier, it means that the decision-making in the hospital around whether they're fit for surgery or not is not left too late. You know, you can be a bit more proactive. You can provide a Sleepius to patients much earlier in the pathway. You know, when they have had the consultation with the clinician that and they've agreed to the surgery, they could be fitted with SurgeFit, you know, straight away, as opposed to having to wait to come in. And some patients are waiting, you know, up to 10 or 11 weeks to get their pre-op assessment done. And they're sitting at home worrying about it, you know. And if the assessment is done earlier, it gives them some assurance. And that's the sort of feedback that we've had from patients. But, you know, in our big clinical study that we did, we were really surprised. We didn't know how patients would react to this kind of an assessment. But 95% of patients said that they actually preferred a Sleepius over the traditional pre-op service. And there was quite a few different reasons for that. One was they liked the idea and the convenience of it and the fact that it was patient friendly and really, really, really easy to use, you know. But the patients also said they felt that if their clinician knew more about them, that gave them greater confidence in the clinical decisions that they were making. Because those patients that went through the arm of the study, they were going through the traditional pre-op assessment, they knew that it was single sets of data. So they're a bit more confident in the fact that we were capturing more data to do better risk assessment.
So Michael, just on a Sleepius, so how does it improve patient outcomes or streamline healthcare processes?
because we're using integrated wearable sensor technology, we can integrate that data into perioperative workflows and therefore provide more objective, dynamic and continuous physiological data, which will enhance that risk stratification of patients. At the same time, identify patients which are fittest for surgery. So it helps the hospital prioritize patients. A really good example, actually, is that I was spoken to a trust about a month ago, and I said, what happens when you get cancellations on the surgical wait list? And they said to me, well, what we do is we ring up the next 10 patients on the list. And I said, well, how successful is that? And they said, well, we probably get to maybe subject seven, patient seven, and we find that they could come in because the number 10, 9, 8, and 7 aren't suitable or can't come in for surgery. And I said, well, you know, of those 10, do you know of those 10, which are the fittest for surgery? Which ones could come in immediately? And so, no, we don't. We don't know that information. Okay. So that's something where the sleepiest could help with, because if we've risk stratified all of the patients preoperatively, then there will be a weighting and a score associated with them, so that the hospital would know who could immediately come in for a cancellation. So that's one of the benefits of patient optimization of the pathway that the sleepiest can deliver. But at the same time, you know, what's really important is what's happening during that surgical process. And if you've risk assessed everybody and risk stratified them more effectively, because we've got more data, then it will improve that clinical decision making, so that the whole clinical team, the whole surgical team, can make very bespoke decisions around that patient. And the other thing that's quite interesting is that across the NHS, one of the key drivers, particularly around getting it right first time, is making sure that we're doing shared decision making with the patient. If the clinicians are relying on single sets of data, then they can't undertake proper shared clinical decision making. The very fact that we're able to provide more data to the clinicians means that they can effectively do more bespoke shared decision making with the patient, which is a really, really good thing. And of course, risk stratify the means that we can improve and deliver more successful surgeries. And the other thing is that it will definitely produce faster post-op recovery and discharge of patients, and then hopefully fewer readmissions. And that goes back to my earlier point about the 1 in 8 patients being readmitted to hospital. If we can just change that needle slightly, then that will reduce the cost impact of the 13 billion that we're spending every year on treating and managing those readmissions. And the other thing is that, you know, that we've done quite an awful lot of work on this. In terms of patients themselves, it only takes 15 minutes for the patient to be fitted with SurgFit. And there's a big efficiency gain there straight away. At the moment, patients are spending anything between 100 and 120 minutes in active consultation with people in the pre-op services at the moment, whether it's using the CPET exercise testing or whether it's not using it and just using the traditional pre-op assessment process. You know, 120 minutes compared to 15 in terms of efficiency is quite a marked difference. You know, 4 patients could be fitted with a sleepiest or SurgFit and sent back home compared to 1 patient being assessed in the current system. So you can see there's a straight away an efficiency capacity gain, which can be made by hospitals, freeing up the time to see more patients, you know, and maybe install more patients on SurgFit as an alternative.
So that brings us nicely onto your success stories or projects that you've got live. You mentioned some research. So where are you at the moment with live deployments or moving the product into a live environment?
We've spent the last year and a half building our product, okay, and getting our product properly regulated so that we can go to market. And we've still got a final few things that we need to do, Tim, at the end of our regulatory roadmap, which is preparing for our DCB 0129, which is a requirement for NHS hospitals. So we should have that finished. So our product will be ready to go live in February of this year. And we need that in order to do some evaluations with hospitals. And so we're working with Leeds and we're working with several other NHS teaching hospitals around the country, because the traction has been absolutely amazing and the appetite for our technology has been amazing. So we're going to conduct some short evaluations with hospital trusts, not on clinical effectiveness, but just on the utility. So we'll perform some of those. We did complete our large-scale clinical study, which we did in partnership with Leeds University Teaching Trust. And we were comparing the utility and the effectiveness of SurgFit against the gold standard, which is the standard exercise testing CPET. Now, we're still analysing a lot of data. There was a huge amount of data. And in fact, I'm really proud to say that the team that were involved in project managing the study did brilliantly well. I've run lots of clinical studies in the past, and the number of patients that fully completed the study was higher than the anticipated. And we lost very few patients to follow up, which was amazing. So we're sitting on an awful lot of data, which we're still currently analyzing. What's interesting about that data is that we're already able to see that Certrid is definitely not inferior to the exercise testing in terms of capturing data. But at the same time, we're capturing even more data, and we need to just fully analyze the benefit of that. We're embarking on a two-year program of work to build some predictive software, which we will have to get regulated as a medical device. And we'll incorporate that into the platform at a later stage, because that will then fully automate the perioperative pathway. The outputs of those algorithms need to be inputted into NHS hospital systems. The benefit of our technology is that it's been used remotely in patients' own homes. And as I said, 95% of patients preferred it over the current assessment program. That's a success story around our data that we have at the moment, and we're very proud of it. And as I said, at the same time, we're going to be doing more evaluations of it in specific hospitals, because every hospital approaches the pathway in a slightly different way. With the best will in the world, I'd love to say that preoperative assessment is done standardly across the NHS. It's not. There's an awful lot of variation in methodology. Some hospitals use CPET 95% of the time, some of them 60% of the time. You know, so there's variability in the practices, and therefore there's variability in the service model that they have. And so that's why it's really important that we do evaluations with individual trusts to make sure that we're demonstrating the benefit of the utility of it within those trusts. And so those are just some of the success stories around the data that we're collecting. But there are others. You know, for example, we were really, really fortunate to be accepted on the Yorkshire Number Propel program.
It's a good program.
Oh, do you know what, Tim? It's the best digital health accelerator in the UK. It absolutely is. You know, we've learned really an awful lot from that. It was great exposure across the whole of the Yorkshire Digital Cluster, and it's definitely enhanced our relationships with clinicians and stakeholders across the community. With the partners within Propel, it meant that we were able to engage with a lot more stakeholders than we would have done if we'd been outside of the program. It's been a great experience so far, but we're still on the program. You know, we're still on it until all through 2025. Once you're on a digital health accelerator, it changes the perception of your innovation.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it sounds like, Michael, you're going to be shortly going into the sort of the adoption and scale stage. You know, you're starting to get traction. People are starting to see the value. You've got a clear roadmap in terms of your evaluation and what have you. What are your thoughts or ambitions over the next sort of 12 to 18 months in terms of adoption and scale?
We haven't been around that long, Tim, to be perfectly honest, as a company. So I'm really, really pleased to say that we are ahead of schedule in terms of where we thought we would be. I mean, our technology is built. You know, we're pretty much ready to go. The appetite from NHS Hospital Trust has been absolutely amazing. We can talk a bit more about that later on if you want. And we've, you know, been successful in getting onto a lot of programs. So our plan is to run our pilots over the next 6 months, four or five pilots across the UK, two or three pilots in lower abdominal surgery, and then two or three in orthopedic surgeries. So, you know, we're having conversations with the National Trauma Orthopedic Centre, Stanmore, another orthopedic centre, Leeds, Cambridge and Kent, including Surrey and Richmond as well, all wanting to pilot our innovation. I'm under no illusions that getting pilots delivered isn't straightforward. You know, have to go through ethics, you have to go through approvals. We know all of that. But, you know, those pilots were relatively short. The pilots will run for about maybe 2 months or whatever. But we only need small volumes of patients on those pilots because they said we're only testing the utility of them compared to the standard traditional pre-op. And then from there, we will build some use cases and then business cases. And we fully plan to publish those and circulate those amongst the wider community. And, you know, our ambition is with the organizations that we're working with, at the same time, from those business cases, generate what the reimbursement strategy will be around our service and then start supplying the hospitals with it. We're not trying to boil the ocean, you know, and switch hospitals over onto Certrid immediately. That's not the case. It's about finding the right kind of patient that would be suitable for Certrid and then building our business that way.
So we're coming to the tail end of the podcast. Michael, so with your evaluation and your tech, what type of feedback have you received from end users or people involved with it?
Yeah, we started that process really early, Tim, actually. And that's one piece of advice I'd be giving to any other innovator that's out there at the moment. You know, we've conducted over 100 interviews with surgeons, anaesthetists, hospital payers, and patients in the UK and the Middle East and Europe. You know, we went wide because, as I said to you, preoperative assessment isn't just done in the UK. You know, the markets who we'll be pivoting to will be European countries, the Middle East and the US. The process that they follow was exactly the same that we follow here in the UK. And they said that a remote assessment service is definitely a game changer. And they have referred to it as a major breakthrough in improving surgical preoperative assessment. But even the patients that we consulted with, they said it's a major step forward and how their surgical pre-op assessments will be conducted in the future. For me, that's just gold dust information, you know. So we know we're on the right track. So Professor David Jain, he's a co-directorial surgeon at Leeds, and he's the clinical co-director for the NHR Health Tech Research Centre here at Leeds University, which is the Accelerated Surgical Care Unit. David says that there's an unmet need for hospitals for inclusive, accurate, patient-friendly pre-operative assessment tools to enable appropriate restratification of care and shared decision-making. And so that's a quote directly from David, you know, and we've had that echoed by many surgeons and anaesthetists across the country. And then some people may have heard of Dame Barbara Haken. She's the chair of the Health Tech Alliance. She's former deputy CEO of the NHS England. And Barbara says that the sleepy system offers significant opportunity to bring surgical preoperative assessment practice into the modern world. And then Barbara goes on to say, which in turn will help tackle the growing number of patients on elective surgical waiting lists. So this goes back to my point about risk stratification, prioritization of waiting lists. The more information and data that we have on the patients, the greater the efficiency gains will be for patients. But at the same time, you know, for patients to deliver better and safer surgical care.
Mm-hmm. And that fits into the sort of industry trends, really. I mean, you know, you're at the forefront of technology. You're bringing different pathway, different ways of working into the NHS. What are your thoughts about future trends? So will this continue? Will it grow? Is there going to be more care at home? What are your thoughts on that, being at the sort of forefront of this area?
Somebody asked me about this the other day, actually. If there were sort of five trends that we're going to be seeing over the next year, year and a half, what would they be? Well, first of all, going back to my point about the fact that billions of people around the world have got a smart device, and they're already using the smart devices for a number of different things, I do believe that we're going to see better patient acceptance for the use of technology in healthcare. Absolutely. If I was to rewind about 5 years ago, the NHS used to tell me, well, older patients will never use a mobile phone, you know. They'll never use a smartphone. That is just not true. If we are seeing people in their 70s and their 80s using smart technologies, it could be an iPad or whatever it is, but they are using them, you know. So that myth is being completely blown out of the water. This acceptance about people collecting data or using technology to collect the data will become more acceptable. And certainly the second one is about this rise in app-based healthcare data collection. You know, people are very happy with apps being used to collect their data, and they're wanting to share their data. We used to think that they were very proprietary over it. They wouldn't want to share it. But certainly people are becoming more amenable to sharing the data in that way with their healthcare professional. But certainly the use of that technology in remote settings is the third area that I think we'll see the growth in. You know, we're seeing an awful lot of medtech being used in virtual care settings, you know, but we will see an explosion of that, I think, with services moving out of hospital in the future. It's really important that non-essential services could be removed into primary care because it's just costing too much to keep them in hospital. And there are alternative ways of assessing patients, just like a sleepiest can do. There's definitely going to be a rise in remote healthcare. And I think there's going to be a very specific focus on health technologies that address health inequalities. These health inequalities are affecting people's access to healthcare. So, for example, if somebody with a physicality issue, a mobility issue, they can't actually get to the hospital for the pre-op assessment. It requires a lot of support, maybe an ambulance, maybe somehow to get up the stairs. A lot of assistance is required. And mobile technologies can address that. You know, even with a sleepiest, for example, you know, we're providing a mobile phone with a data package on it, you know, to collect the data. You know, that's addressing data poverty. A lot of mobile services at the moment rely on the patient to download the app onto their phone. And some of these apps are consuming quite a lot of data, you know, and transferring it up to the innovator's cloud platform, you know. And there are people that would be precluded from using that sort of a system because they haven't got enough data on their mobile service. So, you know, we're addressing that health inequality by immediately providing people with a mobile phone with the app enabled on it. And then the other thing that we're definitely going to see over the next year is that at last, everybody's getting real over the overpromise of AI. Now, AI is a nightmare to try and regulate. I don't refer to our predictive software that we're generating as AI because it makes it easier for us to regulate it. And at the same time, we're setting realistic expectations with the investors that we're speaking to as well. So those are just, five of the key things that I expect to see over the coming year and a half.
Yeah, it sounds like an exciting time, really, with the cutting edge technology that's coming through. Okay, so that brings us to the close of the podcast, Michael. So how would any interested parties, innovators reach out to you? What are your main channels for contact?
Yeah, we use LinkedIn an awful lot, actually. So, if people want to reach out to me, they can find me. There's only one Michael Morgan Curran on LinkedIn, so it makes easy for people to find me. And I like LinkedIn, but clinicians use it these days. You'd be surprised how many NHS consultants or clinicians are on it as well. So I use that as a communication medium. And if people want to reach us, they can go to our website directly, because on our website and indeed on LinkedIn. So I'm more than happy to talk to anybody, share my experience, share our journey so far. And there may be some innovators out there that want to collaborate with us, which would be great. There's one thing that's really important that innovators forget is that they believe their innovation is going to deliver everything. Okay. Unfortunately, there are innovations everywhere along the patient pathway, and they're all building up to that collective gain. So it's really important that you know who's on your pathway or who's innovating in your area, and then making sure that you're working collectively together and in a collaborative way.
Yeah, totally agree. Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for being on the podcast, and I look forward to hearing on your future ventures and progress. So thanks a lot.
Tim, it's been great speaking to you. I look forward to seeing you soon. All right, take care.
In the next episode, we will be speaking to George Kowalski, the Vice President of Business Management at MyCare Limited, who are currently on the Propel programme and are enabling independence for older adults through the use of AI, home sensors, and health devices.